We're constantly seeing rework because the healthcare system, doesn't do a good job taking care of these patients. Not a lot of justification for that.
Welcome to Off the Chart, a business and medicine podcast featuring lively and informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about the challenges facing doctors and medical practices. My name is Austin Luttrell. I'm the assistant editor of Medical Economics, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today. In this episode, Medical Economics senior editor Richard Payerton sits down with Dr. Kevin Shulman, an internal medicine physician and professor of medicine at Stanford University. Dr. Shulman is the co-author of recent research arguing that U.S. healthcare leaders should borrow lessons from other industries to tackle one of the system's biggest problems, the massive costs of administration. They're discussing the scale of the issue from hundreds of thousands of billing codes to billions of negotiated prices, and how precedence thinking could help identify proven solutions from sectors like finance, aviation, and technology. Dr. Shulman explains why the problem isn't intractable, what standardized contracts and digital infrastructure might look like, and how healthcare could lower costs while making life easier for both patients and physicians. Dr. Shulman, thank you for joining us, and now let's get into the episode.
Dr. Shulman, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Today we're going to talk about a couple papers in which you were a lead or corresponding author regarding administrative burdens in the U.S. healthcare system, and then also talking about precedence thinking as a means of hopefully alleviating some of that administrative burden. Just to begin at the beginning, how would you describe the scope and scale of administrative burden in the U.S. healthcare market?
So the data suggests that we spend about a third of healthcare costs on administrative work. About 67%, two-thirds of that money is going to things around billing and transactions. So at a high level, we have to realize we spend more money to manage the U.S. healthcare system than France, Germany, and Italy combined spend on healthcare. We have 318,000 different health plans in the U.S. market. We bill for 600,000 services. We have 57 billion negotiated prices, or 94,000 prices per SKU. So there's no justification for that kind of complexity and that kind of chaos in the market. And that's what's driving, we believe that's what's driving, these tremendous, administrative costs in the U.S.
This has been something that we've reported on quite a bit, both in academic studies as well as just anecdotal evidence. But as a physician and researcher, do you have any examples of feeling frustrated by administrative burdens in your own work?
Yeah, so we looked at a couple of years ago, we looked at the cost of submitting a bill. And for a primary care doctor to submit a bill, it cost $20.49. And that was almost a decade ago now. When I see patients on clinical service, I'm a hospital medicine. As soon as I see a patient, I have to ask, I get a query about coding related questions. I have to document all kinds of data that really aren't clinically meaningful that we use for billing. And I'm fortunate because I'm not dealing with prior auth processes. I will tell you, when I discharge a patient, patients come to my service from the emergency room. When I discharge them, we spend, we get them well taken care of during their stay in the hospital. We come up with a really fabulous follow-up plan, and then they're out of network for every, follow-up service that we can imagine. And so, we're constantly seeing, rework because the healthcare system, doesn't do a good job taking care of these patients. And a lot, not a lot of justification for that.
Like I said, with your paper regarding precedence thinking, frankly, I thought it was very interesting. Wasn't exactly familiar with that term when I started to read that. For those not familiar with the term, can you explain what is precedence thinking?
Yeah, so, this idea, the descriptive data we had, we're pretty comfortable. We understand why administrative costs are so high, you know, what the problem is. At its core, we took an analog business process and digitized it. We never created a digital process. So when you pull out your insurance card, you're paying 30% transaction costs. When you pull out your credit card, you're paying 2% or 3%. As an exercise in class, I have everyone pull out their insurance card and take a look at it and see what's wrong. And if you do that exercise, you will see that there is no barcode, there's no chip. It's a totally analog process. Okay. You know, you go to the doc, they scan it, they type it. You know, it's great 1980s technology, but this is 2025. So we've characterized the problem. The other part of the problem that we've characterized is no one's in charge of these transactions. So every health plan has their own schema that makes sense for them, but there are multiple different health plans in the market. Nobody's responsible for building a single set of rails or pipes to make transactions efficient for health plans and providers across the market and to reduce the cost of healthcare for all of us. So that's a, you know, statement of the problem and descriptive work. Some of my colleagues, Stefano Zenios and Ken Fabro over at the business school, have been working on this theory. You know, Stanford's a lot about innovation. And we do design with, you know, our design school is about needs-based innovation. It's an amazing kind of concept. You know, companies like DoorDash came out of this process. But the process is go very deep to make sure you understand what the need is before you build a solution. And generally, the need-based finding is, you know, really robust, but the solutioning is go in a room with a bunch of really brilliant people and put little yellow sticky notes on the wall to see if you get an idea that might work. And Ken and Stefanos were not satisfied with that. And they said, you know, it's really hard to invest a lot of money in a sticky note. But for really large changes like the one that we're talking about, you know, there have to be better ways of doing this. And so precedence thinking takes design thinking to another level and says every business problem in the world has been solved by somebody somewhere. And if you could articulate a problem, you could actually develop a solution. You know, you could see whether you could identify other solutions and see whether they you can bring them back to your problem. And they just published on that in Harvard Business Review just this spring, but we were using that methodology for a year before that at the business school. And so we said, well, let's try it with administrative costs. And this fundamental notion that we have an analog process that was digitized, it wasn't a digital process, and we don't have this standardization across the market. And when we did that, we had a brilliant student team that went out and found us 82 different firms and markets that have analyzed some or all of this problem or addressed some or all of this problem. Very few of them in healthcare, a lot of them in other industries, a lot in banking, for example. And then, you know, it's very easy to see that you could port those things back. I still, she gets embarrassed when I say this. One of the students working on the project had been working on this issue actually with some consulting firms and some other researchers for a long time before she came to Stanford. And halfway through the project, she said, oh my God, this is a solvable problem. You know, so it's been solved through the public sector, through public-private partnerships, and in the private sector. And so a couple of the precedents, people who have solved analogous problems. One that I love to highlight is mortgages. So it turns out in the 1960s, banking was a great business. You know, the FDIC set passbook interest rates. Banks could then loan mortgages at above the interest rates and go, you know, and the banker could go play golf all day. The way we wrote mortgages in the 1960s was a custom. You know, the reason why you would go to a certain bank is they would write a custom mortgage for you. So at the end of the 1960s, we started developing money market funds. And so interest rates and money market funds were higher than passbook savings rates. And so people started moving their money out of banks, savings banks, and into money market funds. And all of a sudden, as the baby boom generation was about to buy a house, the money for mortgages dried up in the US market. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in 1970 were charged with syndicating mortgages as a way of generating capital for banks and for mortgages. And when they looked at the mortgage market, it was a mess because every contract was different. And so the first thing they did was syndicate or was standardized all of the mortgage contracts in the US. And so today, if you buy a house, you're still using Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac contracts at its core. And so they were able to standardize the mortgage. And in fact, if you go back in the statistics, there was no mortgage interest rate, that's in the New York Times every week until the mortgages were standardized. And so that only dates to the early 1970s. There was no interest rate, standard interest rate before that on mortgages. But that was a public sector approach. The exact opposite was in the private sector with the SWIFT network. The interbank transfer of funds was technology that was developed by banks. They had to move money around, and they did it before the government got involved. So that was SWIFT. A couple other, public-private partnerships. A really interesting one is related to mobile phones. So we sell 1 billion mobile phones a year. And so the only way to sell a billion of any product is it has to be totally standardized. But none of us want to spend $1,000 for the same phone as last year. And so they have to innovate as well. So they have to standardize and innovate, which is a really interesting set of challenges. And the way the phone market does that is through something called standard settings organizations. So your phone's a whole bunch of different components. All year, those component manufacturers are innovating to try and come up with a new and improved phone modem or whatever their piece of technology is. And then the industry literally sits down once a year and comes up with has everyone present their ideas and then picks a winner. And if they pick your idea, then you get royalties from everybody else and we use your idea. If you're using someone else's idea, you pay royalties, but you still get to use their technology. And then we move forward. So, that's really interesting model of a public-private partnership. The Federal Trade Commission sits on some of those standard setting organizations to make sure it's not monopolistic in terms of what the royalty rates are. But that's a public-private partnership model. Another public model was the origin of the FAA. So originally, airline operations, just like health plan payment rules, were totally the responsibility of the airline. And then, unfortunately, in 1956, two planes crashed into each other over the Grand Canyon in broad daylight. And the government said, "This is ridiculous. We can only have one set of rules for flight operations." And we created the FAA to standardize route planning for airlines. So we could easily imagine something analogous where we say we don't like the current system. This makes no sense to have all this complexity, needless complexity. There's no studies that this complexity adds value, other than, I guess, to shareholders of some of the companies involved. We could move forward to a different platform and different set of transactions that would still be computable, customizable to the degree that they're computable. So you could have different offerings from different health plans, but we'd have one set of payment rules and one set of rail transaction platforms.
Say, Keith, this is all well and good, but what if someone is looking for more clinical information?
Oh. Then they want to check out our sister site, patientcareonline.com, the leading clinical resource for primary care physicians. Again, that's patientcareonline.com.
Doctor, so far I've enjoyed our conversation, not least because you use a couple very tangible examples. I have my phone right here to help me record. I'm thinking about my insurance card in my pocket. It's in my pants pocket right now as we speak. And I really like some of those examples. Just to play the devil's advocate here, there might be some people who say, with cell phones, even with something as complicated as aircraft safety guidelines, flight plans. Again, those are mechanical things. Healthcare is different. It's complex. Every patient is different. How would you respond to that?
You know, I think, you know, complexity, you know, so we've looked at, you know, if patients are complex, we've looked at other markets. So we've looked at the administrative costs, you know, billing transaction costs in the U.S. and other markets. Netherlands has a private multi-payer market, a very high-performing healthcare system, life expectancy greater than the United States, and their transaction costs are one-tenth of ours. So, you know, yes, it's complex, but people have mastered that complexity in lots of different ways. We make it more complex by making it analog. So at underlying our system, you know, everyone talks about prior authorization. So what's prior authorization? So health plan says, well, I want to make sure that there's a reason to order this $5,000 test or do this procedure. You know, based on whatever clinical criteria they come up with, if, you know, if they even have a standard set of clinical criteria. And then they ask for clinical documentation. So what's clinical documentation? Analog, text, you know, fill out a form, send a fax. The only place we use faxes in the United States right now is in healthcare to communicate with health plans. And then someone has to read it. And decide, make a judgment, well, is this justified or not based on our criteria? Totally an analog process. And then they go back and then, you know, maybe they reject the claim. Then we got to do an appeal and then we get on the phone. You know, we have this peer-to-peer evaluation thing where someone at the health plan gets on the phone with the doctor to see why they're doing this. Well, the health plan has not taken care of the patient, you know, and, but a totally, totally an analog process. So we just spent, you know, $500, $1,000 on utilization review when there's a 7 to 99% chance they're going to approve this thing anyway. Like, what's the value of all that? We are looking right now, actually, in Taiwan. Taiwan has a national health service. You know, one of the answers Bernie Sanders, you know, put forward a couple of years back was, the administrative costs in the U.S. are too high, and he's absolutely right. It's too complex, and it hurts people. So we should have a single-payer system. So one of the things that our work says is those are two different sets of issues. How we run the payment models is different than how we finance them. And, you know, the American public doesn't want to change the way we finance healthcare, it seems. But, and lots of good reasons to not do that. But that doesn't mean we don't want to change the way we run the payment rails. So I, you know, our work says those are two separate decisions. Fine, keep, if you want to keep the financing structure the way it is, that's perfectly fine. We could still reform the way we pay for services and come up with a much more efficient solution. So I'd like to drive from 30% transaction costs to 5% transaction costs. You know, and I think that's totally doable. The other thing that's coming up now is we're unfortunately excited about this as a catalyst for our work to move it forward is an issue of fraud. So analog systems are really vulnerable to AI and bad actors. And so, you know, we're starting to hear things about digital spoofing of providers as a way of stealing money from health plans in the public and private sector. You know, so we might have to move to a more secure transaction platform to protect us from AI. And in doing so, we'd have to go to a pure digital payment model. And so that could be a great catalyst to bring forward a lot of the work that we're doing. You know, it's unfortunate that fraud's the reason why people might adopt these things rather than the inefficiency of the market, but I think we'll all be better off as a result.
You've talked a little bit about the digitization in the market and potential improvements there. The paper also notes an important distinction between centralization and standardization when creating processes or protocols to solve problems in business. Can you talk about that distinction?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to 2020, Elizabeth Warren put together a proposal for how she would finance and administer the Medicare for All program. And it was this 2-page spread in the New York Times. Like, had that, if anyone took a look at it. And it was the scariest document I ever saw. The United States government's not set up to manage a $5 trillion healthcare economy, frankly. And I got a lot of pushback at the time. Like, Bernie's saying, well, he's going to reduce administrative costs, but Medicare isn't the most facile of payers. So the Medicare program passed in 1965. Medicare didn't have a screening benefit till the 1990s. So it didn't pay for screening mammography, screening colonoscopy, screening PSA exams. Medicare passed in 1965 and didn't have an oral drug benefit until 2006. So if you want a health plan where it takes 40 years to add critical benefits like prevention or oral drugs, in a world that's changing with AI digital services, think about a single payer system. So I think what we want, we want our cake and eat it too. We want more efficient transactions and more efficient transaction processes. We don't necessarily want one healthcare czar in charge of health plans and what healthcare looks like. And we have lots of diverse opinions about what that could be, depending on which political party you're in, or economic philosophy. So I think keeping the structure, if we could keep the current structure of a mixed public-private system that has fostered huge amounts of innovation in the U.S. healthcare market, but we don't have to pay these administrative costs to achieve that.
Hey there, Keith Reynolds here, and welcome to the P2 Management Minute. In just 60 seconds, we deliver proven, real-world tactics you can plug into your practice today, whether that means speeding up check-in, lifting staff morale, or nudging patient satisfaction north. No theory, no fluff, just the kind of guidance that fits between appointments and moves the needle before lunch. But the best ideas don't all come from our newsroom. They come from you. Got a clever workflow hack, an employee engagement win, or a lesson learned the hard way? I want to feature it. Shoot me an email at kreynolds@mjhlifesciences.com with your topic, a quick outline, or even a smartphone clip. We'll handle the rest and get your insights in front of your peers nationwide. Let's make every minute count together. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you in the next P2 Management Minute.
To maybe continue along the lines of some of the items that would work with digitization, the paper mentions about using modularized machine-readable contracts. And using those type contracts to sort of customize the agreements between payers and patients and providers, for example. Can you talk about the importance of those modularized contracts in a new payment system?
Yeah, so we're saying we should start at the beginning and just rebuild this. So in the United States, every health plan and every provider have to negotiate a contract. Those contracts they're all confidential, so I can't tell you. I can't generalize a lot, but in general, they cover exactly the same thing. They might have 3 days. I have to pay in 3 days versus 7. Here, I might have this kind of adjudication process or that. Again, going back to mortgages, where we're using, when you bought your, if you bought your house, you bought it on a Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac contract. And with digital tools today, we could have this totally digitally adjudicated in terms of the contract. We've gone through contracts that we've access to. Almost everything in the contract can be digitized. Our friends in the legal profession won't love the fact that they renegotiate. You don't have to renegotiate from scratch every single year. But it, why do that? That doesn't necessarily add a lot of value. Again, when you end up at the almost exact same spot, the place where there is difference is in generally in the provider manuals around the rules around prior authorization. And again, lots of pushback on the industry. The industry even finally came out and said they were going to try and do something about standardization over the next 3 years. But I think we could accelerate that. and again, move that to a digital tool. At some level, this whole idea about prior authorization is, again, an analog discussion, right? It's I'm going to review the chart and see if your judgment's an appropriate one for this patient. Okay, well, that's, yeah, obviously that's what they're paying me to do in the first place. And, you know, if they want to spend 45 minutes with the patient interviewing them and come to this decision, you know, that'd be great, which is not what the process is. But we should think about fraud, waste, and abuse not as analog, but as digital. And again, fraud, I think we need to deal with fraud in terms of robust digital and secure transactions. But the waste and abuse that prior authorization doesn't deal with fraud, it's waste and abuse. Well, we could do that digitally. Like if there was one set of transaction platforms, you'd know really quickly that this cardiologist's practice pattern is, you know, over two standard deviations from the norm, and maybe you should go review their charts. So instead of prior auth the entire 100% distribution of physicians around specific services, if we're worried about waste and abuse, let's go after people that practice outside of the norm. Leave the people who practice within the norm alone because they're doing a great job. But instead, we take these analog tools, we apply them to the entire population in an incredibly inefficient fashion and an incredibly expensive fashion, you know, that basically destroys doctors' lives, it destroys doctors' motivation to continue to do what they're doing, you know, and again, in terms of productivity, to have three, four, five people in your office to have to deal with getting paid for doing services, or a lot of times you're not even getting paid. You get prior auth on a medication from a PBM. You're not getting any payment from the PBM in the first place. You're not getting paid to dispense that medication. Like it's, you know, it's a total loss to the docs to have to spend any time on that.
You know what, doctor, that's a great segue to a question I wanted to make sure I get to, because there's a financial component here, but there's also a kind of quality of work component, so to speak. And I made a long career as a community journalist. When I came to medical economics, frankly, I was really surprised to learn about the extent of burnout among physicians and other clinicians. And you yourself are a practicing physician. Just wanted to ask your thoughts about if the nation really embarked on a serious journey to reduce administrative burdens in healthcare, what do you think that would do to help work environment and burnout among physicians and other clinicians?
It'd be a huge positive. I mean, the way this all gets pushed back on docs, on frontline docs, like at the end of the day, one is, you know, when the hospital, you know, so now, you know, most docs are now employed by hospitals. The majority of docs are employed by hospitals, which is a shift over the last decade. And part of it was they just couldn't keep up with all this as a practice. It was incredibly inefficient. And, you know, if the hospital doesn't know what the rules are to get paid for the service, then they have to be incredibly conservative. And they have to ask me to, again, code my chart, to answer queries, all these payment-related things, tasks that we never had before, that you know, are there right now because they can't predict it, you know, what the insurance company is going to ask for to get paid for, you know, appropriately paid for services that were provided. Unfortunately, AI is going to be used to make that even worse. So I just saw some data from our place that using an AI query tool, you know, improved our ability to negotiate with health plans, but it doubled the number of queries that docs got. Our population's aging, the pressures on the healthcare workforce are increasing, and our time's being sucked into typing in Epic, doing all these non-productive things, rather than, you know, doing what we're trained to do, take care of patients, go talk to their families, you know, help them on their care journey, help them get to from what, you know, when I do hospital medicine, it's a crisis. There was some failure of the healthcare system for this patient that caused them to have to come to the emergency room and get admitted to the hospital. How can I help them figure out the next step in their journey. But instead, I'm answering queries to get help the hospital get paid.
Doctor, this is there's a couple questions that come up now in every interview, and I it makes me chuckle only because there's a couple issues that have become so predominant so quickly in healthcare. But you and your colleagues used artificial intelligence programs to research the precedence thinking involved that could be helpful to healthcare. Can you talk a little bit about how you used AI in your research, and then what's going to be the role of AI in hopefully a revised approval system and payment system?
Well, we used it in the research after everyone got done brainstorming, like which industries, what might be good examples. We asked AI, do you have any other ideas? And they came up with a couple more. So that was great. Right now in a world without rules, no one's in charge of the healthcare system. And so if Cigna or Aetna or United puts in an AI, process, first off, they're different. They're totally inconsistent with each other. And that's going to drive changes in how Stanford submits its bills, and drive more complexity. In every other aspect, of the economy, AI is being used to drive productivity. And without some set of constraints in healthcare, AI is going to exacerbate the administrative costs and will literally drive physicians out of the workforce. Our physician population is aging with the rest of the population. And people have to make a choice. Do I want to continue to work where we're short docs, short potentially several hundred thousand docs, but we also have a whole bunch of people that are retirement age or approaching retirement age, and if they don't want to stay because it's just too much of a hassle, especially for an older physician who's been in practice 20, 30 years, this wasn't part of their lives 20, 30 years ago. You only had to type 15, literally typing notes and things like that's a decade long. I think we have to really seriously consider if we use AI to drive down patient, physician satisfaction and drive people out of the workforce, there's no one to replace them.
Frankly, kind of a scary thought in that regard. A moment ago, I had referred to kind of two questions that come up in every interview now. One deals with AI programs, and the other one, of course, is the new administration, still relatively new, and the initiative to make America healthy again. And you touched on this a little bit ago about especially government efforts to root out waste, fraud, and abuse. But with precedence thinking and revisions to the administrative process in healthcare, how do you see that fitting into the initiative to make America healthy again?
Well, I think, we're in the middle of a huge financial crisis in the United States. So productivity is a big piece of what the issues are with Medicare. Fraud's a big piece of what the issues are with Medicare. So I think it's totally consistent. And in fact, if anything, a huge opportunity for this administration to have a big win by really addressing something that touches every single American. I mean, I can't imagine that there's many people in the United States excited about the administration, how we administer our health benefits today. So it's a win-win-win. This administration has so much leverage over Congress. Congress usually is the rate-limiting step where industry can lobby. There is a generational opportunity to really do something transformative.
One of the other questions I always like to ask in an interview, our main audience is primary care physicians. What would you like to say to them, or what would you like them to know, whether it be about the administrative process or anything?
Well, I think we don't have to accept this. Healthcare cost, the administrative costs, the administrative structure is not, it's not part of the Ten Commandments, not created by God. And it's a choice that people make. I think there's an opportunity for us to really advocate. And now is really the time. I mean, I think before this gets worse, we really have to come together and explain to people what's going on and why we need change.
One thing, and I'm glad you mentioned about among myself and my colleagues, it seems like everybody we talk to, especially about the technology question, is one of the things that we've been noticing is some variation on the theme of, you know, doctors getting ahead of the locomotive, so to speak, get to the head of the train and really drive how AI is going to be used in healthcare. And that's, I think, just very interesting to you know, it's just a recurring theme. And I'm sure you already know this, but you're not alone in you know, talking about that and hopefully using it to an advantage instead of just simply reacting to it. So, Dr. Shulman, it's been a great conversation here to learn more about these administrative burdens and precedence thinking, possible solutions. If I have questions, I'll reach out via email, but otherwise, I just appreciate you taking the time.
No problem. My pleasure. Thanks for reaching out and thanks for spending some time today.
Once again, that was a conversation between medical economics senior editor Richard Payerton and Dr. Kevin Shulman, an internal medicine physician and professor of medicine at Stanford University. My name is Austin Luttrell, and on behalf of the whole medical economics and physicians practice teams, I'd like to thank you for listening to the show and ask that you please subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Be sure to check back on Monday and Thursday mornings for the latest conversations with healthcare experts sharing strategies, stories, and solutions for your practice. You can find us by searching Off the Chart wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if you'd like the best stories that medical economics and physicians practice publish delivered straight to your email 6 days of the week, subscribe to our newsletters at medicaleconomics.com and physicianspractice.com. Off the Chart, a Business and Medicine podcast, is executive produced by Chris Mazzolini and Keith Reynolds and produced by Austin Luttrell. Medical Economics, Physicians Practice, and Patient Care Online are all members of the MJH Life Sciences family. Thank you.